Simpson. For the sake of our filming. I'm Dr. Looper. I'm the director of the McGill Psychiatry Residency Training Program. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Dr. Paris, who is our former chairman of our department. Today, we invited him to come and talk about the history of psychiatry at McGill. The title is McGill Psychiatry, Past Greats and Current Leaders. As you know, we've had many prominent and influential leaders in the field of psychiatry, and thought we would take this occasion to invite Dr. Paris to give us his perspective on it. So welcome, Dr. Paris.
Thanks, Carl. So when I was a medical student, I couldn't understand why anyone wanted to study the history of medicine, because that was the past. But now that I'm old, I think it's very important because we keep, maybe because we might learn something and not make the same mistakes over and over again. I wrote a little history of McGill psychiatry for the previous website, so maybe that's why you invited me, I don't know. So let me start with Ewan Cameron, the famous and infamous first chair of psychiatry at McGill. Now, before 1943, if you can believe it, there was no psychiatry department at McGill University. There was a Douglas Hospital, and it was 7 miles away, it still is, and it was its own world, and there was a little clinic downtown called the Mental Hygiene Institute, but psychiatry was not really practiced at the major teaching hospitals. And Cameron was brought in. He had been superintendent of some mental hospitals in the past. He was Scottish in origin, and I understand he had a fairly heavy Scottish accent, but was an American citizen, had worked for a number of years in Albany, New York, and was brought to Montreal in 1943. Now, Cameron was one of the most powerful figures in world psychiatry. He founded, one of the founders of the World Psychiatric Association. I can remember the first meeting of that organization, not that I attended, but I heard about it when I was a medical student in 1961. It was held here. And I also heard that some people criticized Cameron at that meeting. In his time, he was head of the American Psychiatric Association. He was very influential, very powerful, and arrogant. These were the days when, if you were a chair of a department, you were unchallengeable. It was my fate in life to be young when the old men were powerful, and when I reached maturity, they lost that power, and nobody would listen to them anymore. I can remember in the early 60s when I was a med student, you didn't contradict the head of the department, he knew best. And it was like that with Cameron. If people challenged him, he would say, "Are you saying I don't know how to do research, doc?" This is how he talked. And by the way, I'm only getting this secondhand because of all the heads of psychiatry at McGill, he's the only one that I didn't meet, because he left when I was still a medical student. But I heard a lot about him, and I still was asked questions about him. When I was chair, teams of journalists would come around still investigating the scandal associated with Cameron. Now let's talk about Cameron's positive characteristics first. Obviously very charismatic, self-confidence, vision. And this building, the Allen Memorial Institute, was founded by him. It had been a mansion belonging to shipping magnates named Hugh Allen. and I believe there was mental illness in the family. I'm not quite sure who it was, but this building was passed on to the Allen, and there was, in those days, before there was a Ludmer or research and training building, a big conservatory on the other side where plants were grown. And you can see pictures of what it looked like. So he founded the institution, and one of the interesting things he did was, which I think is part of what has made McGill a good place to work, is to bring in researchers and clinicians of every persuasion, even people he didn't agree with. So, for example, he brought in a psychoanalyst from Vienna, Eric Witkower, Hans Aufreiter, people like that. He, Clifford Scott from England. He had behavior therapists. He had psychopharmacology people. He had a bit of everything, and in fact, as I'll mention later, transcultural psychiatry, which is a big thing at McGill, also started under his leadership. So there was a sense of pluralism. There was no one answer, and people said in those days that the Allen was such an interesting place to work because everybody was always arguing and disagreeing with each other. And of course, the fact that he was a prominent medical politician didn't hurt the department. So what brought down Cameron? Well, arrogance, hubris, and he didn't really understand research. Now, you must realize that research 50 years ago is not what it is today. I wrote a book about a bit about the background of psychiatry some years ago called Prescriptions for the Mind, and I read articles from the American Journal of Psychiatry in the 40s and 50s. You wouldn't believe the stuff that got published. I had 20 cases, and I think I helped half of them, and I have this theory, and I mean, almost anything could get published. So the standards were, in fact, low, although I think his research didn't even really meet the standards of the time. And what did he do that was so controversial? Well, he gave people 100 ECTs in order to erase all their memories. And that was called depatterning. And why did he do that? He did that because he thought that, actually he wasn't strictly biological. He thought that people had all kinds of environmental programs in their brains that could be removed by ECT, and then you could introduce new ones. So after, these confused people would be exposed to what was called psychic driving, which was recordings of voices telling them how to think. Now, it didn't help. Actually, it didn't do as much damage as you would expect. There was a follow-up done by Alex Schwartzman of Concordia in the 60s, where they went and interviewed these patients. And most of them were sort of untouched by, they weren't happy, but they were, you can't really say this experience put them backwards or forwards or anything. It really was useless. And of course, no control groups. None of the things that we would take for granted today. Clinical trials, not to speak of ethics committees. So this led, after the death of Cameron, this led to many, many lawsuits, and the Royal Victoria Hospital had to pay a lot of money to some of these ex-patients. And it was constantly in the newspapers, and you still hear about it, even 50 years after he left. He went back to Albany in 1963, perhaps realizing that this project had failed, lived there for 4 years, and died climbing a mountain that was too high for him in the Adirondacks. So perhaps this puts his life in perspective. So that's Ewan Cameron. Now, Cameron was succeeded by Robert Cleghorn, who I knew fairly well. And the first thing he did when he took over was to stop depatterning and also to fire one particular person who had been one of Cameron's, who had pushed hard this program, and that's a whole other story because this man didn't leave McGill and made a lot of trouble. But anyway, so Cleghorn turned that around. Now, Cleghorn had a different background. He had been trained in psychoanalysis, although I don't think I ever heard him talk about it. Endocrinology, he was also in his background. He was interested in steroids and mental illness. So Cleghorn was a nice Scottish-Canadian of the old school. He was a unifying force. Nobody had much against him. If I have time, I'll tell you a story that happened when I was a resident where he tricked me a little bit, but maybe we'll leave that aside for now. Now, when we talk about McGill greats, there's Heinz Lehmann and there's everybody else. Because Heinz Lehmann was truly a giant, very influential for me. So Heinz Lehmann came from Berlin. He was half Jewish. That half would have been enough to get him killed. But he had the sense to leave just before the war and move to Montreal. And as an immigrant doctor, where could he get a job? Well, in Verdun Protestant Hospital, now the Douglas Hospital. And that's where, in fact, he spent most of his career and developed his reputation. He disapproved of Cameron, quite rightly, and kept his distance from him. But he was head of the residency training when I did in my first year of residency at the Douglas and did a lot of teaching there. This is 1968. And 2 years later, when Cleghorn turned 65 and retired, in those days people stopped at 65, they prevailed on Heinz Lehmann to take over. This was actually a time of crisis for the department because of we had the October crisis of 1970, and many of our faculty moved away. And actually, this was good for young people like me because there were lots of openings to be filled, and people came and say, "Please come work for us," you know, unlike now. And so Heinz Lehmann was chair during that period. And so Heinz Lehmann was perhaps, you know, not totally original in his work, but had tremendous breadth and practicality. So he was the first person in North America to use neuroleptic drugs, antipsychotic drugs, which had been developed in France, as you may know the story, by Delay and Dedekind. And Lehmann had read that literature and started using them at the Douglas and wrote the first report about it. And I can remember, this really dates me, 1958, when I was an undergraduate, and we went out to in the States, and we went out to visit a mental hospital. They were just starting to use chlorpromazine in small doses. So I got to see what a mental hospital was like before chlorpromazine. And I can tell you it was something. And Lehmann was also the first person to introduce imipramine to North America. So this was the source of his fame. And he published hundreds of papers and worked in many areas, mostly psychopharm. But I think his main role was as a kind of an inspiration. He knew a lot. He thought deeply. He didn't take nonsense. A little hard to contradict, but a strong leader. So here, you know, I mentioned his first use of drugs. Tremendous teacher. Used to see patients in 15 minutes and tell you a lot about them, something I've tried to imitate. And he also wrote excellent chapters in the early editions of Kaplan's textbook. So if you go back to the first couple of editions, you'll see pictures of patients from the Douglas, some of whom I recognize, and wonderful descriptions in a phenomenological tradition. He was humble. He didn't drive a car. He went around on a bicycle. If you go down to the Douglas, you'll see a little statue of him riding his bike. He lived in a little house most of his life on the Douglas grounds. He was an idealist. He was followed by Maurice d'Anger, who was still with us in his 80s. Maurice was chair of psychiatry for 11 years. Maurice is from Marseille, France, but he trained under Cameron here in the 1950s. He had been head of psychiatry in Liège, Belgium, and then was brought back here to be head of the Allen, and then became the chair of psychiatry. And Maurice is also a man of great breadth, a deep thinker, a psychoanalyst, but somebody who said psychoanalysis is only for education. You know, it's not a treatment. So quite skeptical. Did a lot of work in neurophysiology, and more recently has been known for his work on substance abuse, which he's carried out of the Douglas since the last 25 years since he stepped down. He's a Chevalier de Légion d'honneur in France, so that's a big honor. And I would describe him as a skeptic who is always open to new ideas. Now, I couldn't find a picture of Gilbert Pinard on the web, and this maybe indicates something about his modesty. Gilbert, perhaps you don't know him because he doesn't come around much anymore. He retired a few years ago. But Gilbert was a beloved figure. He had been at Sherbrooke prior to that at Université de Montréal, and had started out in psychopharm, but later retrained himself in cognitive therapy and was a leader in the development of cognitive therapy here at McGill. And again, a broad interests, a unifying figure. Now, I haven't put my picture up here just for historical reasons. I don't consider myself a McGill great, like the others. But somebody had to do the job, and maybe nobody else wanted it. So I ended up, when Gilbert stepped down, they suddenly realized that they needed an acting chair. And they put me in for a year, and then they said, well, do you want to apply for the job? And I said, well, it doesn't seem that bad. I said naively. So I had that job for the next 10 years. And I think the main things that happened during that era were the combining of the Allen and the Montreal General Psychiatry Departments, which has gone much further since then, so we don't even think of them anymore as separate departments, but that was very controversial and problematic in its time. And then the refurbishment of the R&T building into the Ludmer building, which, as you see, is still happening in a second phase. And Mimi Israel has been similarly went from acting chair to chair and remains a strong leader, very knowledgeable in psychiatry and in Quebec politics, which is increasingly important. It used to be that chairs of departments at McGill had to be high quality researchers with grants and with labs and teams and things like that. But in fact, to do an administrative job, you almost have to give that up. And because, you know, I know one of the other chairs who would have been noted endocrinologist, and I said, my God, this guy is at every meeting. How does he do it? And then I realized, well, he just stopped. He just stopped when he'd be. So this is the kind of job it is. Now, I just want to go over some of the areas in which McGill has excelled. And the first one is psychopharm. So we start with laymen. And there was a man by the name of Thomas Bann, who later on moved to the States, who was equally important. Layman and Bann were a very, very, very close team. Guy Chouinard, I think, has retired now. So maybe you don't know him. He used to be a favorite teacher of the residents. He was inspiring, confident, and gave out lots of reprints. And people really liked him. He did a lot of work on neuroleptics and particularly tardive dyskinesia. He was an expert. So he ran the clinic here, for example, with the injectables. Claude de Montigny has retired also some years ago, and he was perhaps best known for his work on lithium as an adjunct to antidepressants. But in his later years, he did a lot of more basic neurobiology. Transcultural psychiatry has been very important at McGill, and I've been a little bit involved with it peripherally. Eric Witkower was one of the Viennese analysts recruited by Cameron, and he founded a journal which was originally sort of like a collection of reports of psychiatric conditions around the world. He was joined by Ray Prince, who then took this over and ran it for many years. Ray Prince died, I think, about a month ago at the age of 87. And he had your job at first, Carl, for about 6 years. And what eventually happened was this journal turned into a standard peer-reviewed journal called Transcultural Psychiatry. And it really developed high standards under Lawrence Kiermaier, who is obviously still very much with us and is one of the world's most prominent transcultural psychiatrists. I have this joke, which is the saying that I can't believe that Lawrence Kiermaier was ever my student. But I do have him as a medical student. He was always twice as smart as me, you know, but maybe I taught him a little something, who knows. So I think this is something where we continue to excel. We have become a center for eating disorders, and I think the main person who's made that happen is Howard Steiger. And he's done important work on both neurobiology and personality patterns in bulimia and anorexia nervosa. He's very well known, and of course we have the primary eating disorder center in the province, and perhaps the only one that compares with us in Canada is the Toronto General. Genetics is a more recent thing, in 2000 we were going to solve all the problems of psychiatry by genetic research. It turned out to be a disappointment. Nevertheless, if you think about it in the long term and not as a quick fix, I think it's a very productive area. So I'm mentioning here Gustavo Turecki, wonderful man, whose main interest is suicide and particularly genetics in relation to suicide. And Rita Juber, also at Douglas Institute, who's worked on schizophrenia and ADHD. So I think we're moving along in this area too. Addiction research, well, this actually goes back to Juan Carlos de Greti, who hasn't retired, to my knowledge, but perhaps at 80 may have a lower profile these days. But he founded this unit, which had its own building, and now has another building near the Montreal General. Was separately funded by Quebec. And I think the leading researcher now is Catherine Gill, who is also a leader of research at the MUHC. And so I think in addiction research, we're a real player. And I mentioned that Maurice Danger had been involved with this as well in Douglas from a different angle, and there's still work going on there too. Now this picture is of a man who not everybody knows, but believe it or not, he's the most famous member of the McGill faculty by far. And because he's a basic scientist, not all psychiatrists maybe know about him very well. But when, if you go to conferences, and they, in the same way as they used to say, "Oh, McGill, layman," now they'll say McGill. Oh yes, Meany is there, isn't he? Now he recently received the Order of Canada, and he's famous because he, along with a pharmacologist Moshe Schiff, have made very important contributions to the development of epigenetics, which could be the wave of the future, or we don't know yet. Maybe we'll run into the same difficulties we ran into in terms of genetics itself, but certainly it's a very fertile field. Just mentioning some of the newer imaging, because obviously one of the things about McGill, and what actually the reason I came to McGill as a medical student, was I was interested in the brain, and I heard about Penfield, Jasper, Hebb, all these great names at McGill who all quickly retired, after I got here. But the Montreal Neuro remains one of the premier institutions of the world. Just an article in the paper a few days ago about the work being done there on autism. And I just mentioned some members of our department who have close connections with them. Chucky Benkelfat and Marco Leighton here, who have studied impulsivity. And of the Douglas Jorge Amoni, Martin Lepage, and Jens Prusner, looking at emotional processing. So this, again, is more basic research, and it's very well known. Now, child psychiatry, McGill, we could go back in history. The first child psychiatry head, when I was a medical student, was a psychoanalyst by the name of Taylor Statton. Nobody knows him anymore. He didn't do much research. He had a school for disturbed children. He did a bit of psychoanalysis. He wasn't too inspiring. His successor, a man by the name of Kaplan, was much beloved, but also perhaps forgotten, because if you don't publish again, a generation passes and people will not know who you are. Even if you do publish, they may not know who you are. So of today's people, I would focus on Eric von Bunn, who was brought here in 2002 from England and is very well known in the field of autism. And Lily Hechtman, who's been here from almost from the beginning. She was in my class in residency, so she graduated in 1972. This is, by the way, the 40th anniversary of my coming on faculty at McGill this week, so I'm celebrating it by chatting with you guys. Lily Hechtman will also have been here 40 years. She had a mentor named Gabriel Weiss, and they worked together for many years. But Lily has really carried the ball for ADHD for a long time. Some of you may have come here because we teach psychotherapy, more so than some of the other psychiatric residencies in Canada. So we were the first center for psychoanalysis in Canada was here. I mentioned Witkower at Aufreiter from Vienna. Henry Kravitz was a homegrown product, very prominent and psychoanalyst and attractive teacher. He ran the Jewish General Department of Psychiatry for 25 years, which was dominated by two things, psychoanalysis and family therapy, which is still an important element of the Jewish. I think we've had clinical teaching in all forms of psychological treatment, so you all have your long-term cases, and we teach short-term therapy, and I think most of you will now have exposure to CBT, and I think family therapy, mostly if you rotate through the Jewish, you're going to get some experience in that too. So what would I say about McGill psychiatry? First of all, our research hits above its weight, because we're about almost equal, I would say, to the U of T, but the U of T is twice the size of McGill and everything. It has twice the number of faculty, twice the number of medical students, and twice the number of residents. It's the only medical, it's as if the U of M and McGill got together and made one medical school. So considering that we are smaller, Anglophone in a Francophone environment, perhaps because of our history, we still hit above our weight. And we have survived our obituaries many times. Because I can't tell you how many times people say, oh, McGill psychiatry, that was the old days, and it'll never be the same again, and this is how people talk. And yet we still keep producing things. And we combine a clinical teaching and research missions. And I think I was happy to train here, and I hope you're going to feel the same way.
Well, Dr. Paris, thank you very much for providing this wonderful overview of psychiatry at McGill, as well as your own personal insights, which are always adds color to the presentation. I'm sorry that I put you in this awkward position of situating yourself among the greats, which is a well-deserved position, and too modest to describe it accurately. I'd like to add that Dr. Paris is a world-renowned researcher and leader in the field of personality disorders, and has written many books on psychiatry in general, even beyond that discipline. Just out of curiosity, what book number are you on now?
I'm working on the 16th book.
16th book.
It's my books are short. People tell me they're easy to read, and the reason for that is that you're reading draft 27. The secret of writing is to get something down on paper, and the first draft is always awful. And for me, it's usually some kind of a rant, which is all over the place. But at least I have my first draft, and then I can start working on it. And so, you know, this is a bit of a product of my later years, obviously, and wanting to have my say. And I think you will find some of them clinically relevant and interesting. They're all available in our libraries. So also 175 peer-reviewed publications, mostly in the last 20 years. So I have a very peculiar career because I started out as a clinician and a teacher, and I didn't think I could ever be a researcher. And somewhere along the line, I realized that we don't know enough about psychiatry, and I should try to join those who were doing something about that. So I retrained myself in my 40s as a researcher and really only developed this productivity after 50. So if you don't if you don't have a lot of publications by the end of residency, there's lots of time.
So I think we have some time for a few questions. Yes?
What?
Actually,
clopromazine came in when I was an undergraduate student in psychology. By the time I was a resident, it was already being used quite liberally. We had the big event of my residency was the introduction of lithium. And I was the first person at the Jewish General to give lithium to a patient during my residency. It was a patient who had been 25 admissions with various diagnoses, mostly schizophrenia, actually. But in fact, those days we had the opposite problem. We underdiagnosed mania because we didn't have a specific treatment for it. Now, of course, we've gone to the other extreme and everything is mania. But we thought this patient had mania. We gave her lithium, and she got a lot better. And then Henry Kravitz, who was in charge of the ward, said, but she's still on chlorpromazine. How do you know what's working here? Good question. So we took her off the 3 grams of chlorpromazine she was on, left her on lithium, and she was never hospitalized again. 15 years later, I saw her son with a mental illness. But she never went back to the hospital. So it was a kind of a miracle. It was like being present at the first administration of penicillin. So this was an exciting time. But you know, the drugs we had in those days, we don't really have better ones now. I mean, tell me what's better for bipolar, the lithium. There isn't anything. What's better for psychosis than chlorpromazine or its piperazine competitors? You know, not much. I mean, you know, the atypicals, it's been shown clearly, are no better. And we had benzos. And of course, we had tricyclics, which are just as good as SSRI. So the golden age of psychopharmacology was during my residency. This is the time when massive strides were being made and things were coming in that really turned the world of psychiatry upside down.
So what was first and second line treatment for bipolar and schizophrenia at medical school?
Chlorpromazine. And the problem was you could bring them down and they wouldn't stay down. They kept relapsing. And you see these breakthroughs, and that, you know, so that was it was an exciting time to be a resident when things were really developing and changing.
So, other questions? Yes, Dr. Batt.
Thank you, Dr. Batt. I was wondering, what about the future, and what are the general trends and where does the medical see itself?
Yes, well, it's been said that old doctors are always talking about the future of their field because their own future is perhaps a little bit limited. And it's very hard to predict. The one thing I have in common with my younger self is that I'm very critical of my field. When I was a resident, there was a lot of bad things going on, particularly the misuse of psychoanalysis on patients, even psychotic patients, you know, who it didn't benefit, and a lot of other people. And I was very, very unhappy about that. And there was this tremendous ideological belief, you know, in the value of talking above all. And I mean, nevertheless, I was very influenced by psychoanalysis in the sense of listening, the way we listen to patients, the way we empathize with them. And I'm probably one of the few psychiatrists left who does a lot of psychotherapy. Because even though we train you in psychotherapy, you'll find when you get out, you won't do very much, because that's been the pattern now for the last 20 years. Because I treat borderline personality disorder, and because borderline personality disorder's best treatment is particular forms of psychotherapy, I'm still active in that field. I think psychotherapy might be due for a comeback as we become a little bit disillusioned with the way we do psychopharmacology. So I'm very unhappy about the way psychopharmacology is practiced. I wrote a book about that a couple of years ago. Basically, we have 5 groups of drugs, and we give 1 from each to every patient, no matter what their diagnosis. And if they don't get better, we keep piling it on. Switching, adding, you know, until everybody's on polypharmacy. And this is not evidence-based. And It's even spread to the primary care system, so that when I still do several hundred consultations a year, which I find to be very interesting, particularly for a senior person like me. So I find that some of this aggressive psychopharmacology has spread, and the patients even arrive on our doorstep on a lot of drugs. So nothing against drugs. I was there when it all started, and I saw the miracles that drugs could produce, and this was one of my arguments with my more ideologically based psychoanalyst teachers, you know, who wanted to treat psychosis with therapy. But the way psychopharmacology is practiced now, I think, is not so rational. And there may be some kind of backlash against this, and perhaps a return to psychotherapy, but in a different way, because, you know, you don't hear much about psychotherapy research, but psychotherapy is just as evidence-based as psychopharmacology. There's an enormous literature on it, and I think this is a field that is still developing, still finding its feet in a way. And we might come back to that somewhat, although I would like to see one form of psychotherapy. I think psychotherapy has been severely undermined by its division into different schools of thought. When I was chair, I tried to set up a psychotherapy committee and put one of our leading faculty members in charge for integrated teaching of psychotherapy at McGill. The psychoanalysts all enthusiastically joined the committee because they've been feeling very marginalized in recent years and pushed aside, so they all got on the committee. A couple of cognitive people joined, but felt they were outnumbered and left, and the project sort of fell flat. And so I see now, if you'd listen to the top American psychiatrist, Thomas Insel, head of the NIMH, Kupfer and Regier, the designers of DSM-5, they tell you the future of psychiatry lies in neuroscience and neurobiology. And I think that's partly true, but it's but partly untrue. First of all, there's been no practical application of neuroscience to psychiatry whatsoever, in spite of all the hype. And you could practice in the same way as you practiced 30 years ago, and it wouldn't make any difference. And it hasn't helped diagnosis. So they keep telling us that breakthroughs are just around the corner. And just around the corner is just around another corner. And it never seems to quite happen that way. And I think the disillusionment we had with psychiatric genetics over the last 10 years is an example of that. After a while, I think people got tired of discovering candidate genes that explain less than 1% of the variants and didn't have any clinical application. So I'm skeptical in the short term about neurobiology. In the long term, I agree with the vision, but we're talking about 100 years from now. I mean, we are just at the and you won't live to see it either, because I think we are just at the beginning of understanding the brain. I mean, I wanted to understand the brain when I was an undergraduate. Did a lot of work on this in the States at Michigan when I did my psychology degree. Came here with the idea, you know, of continuing that. But the brain is the most complex thing in the universe. It has more connections than there are stars in the galaxy. So it's going to take a long time. In the meantime, I think we don't do such a bad job compared to other physicians of looking after our patients. But in terms of understanding the causes of mental illness, I'd like to wake up in 100 years and see what we found.
So we have time for a few more questions. I actually have one. You did allude to a personal anecdote. I think it was about Dr. Cleghorn.
Yes, I'll do.
I will guarantee you that you'll have the right to be involved in the editing of the video.
Right. No, it's not scandalous. It's a kind of a very Canadian story in a way. We were a group of residents. We had a group of residents who were very challenging and vigorous. And one of the things we did was about four or five of us, under the leadership of really of one particular guy, sort of, who was an older resident who had been a GP, organized a series of debates on hot issues and arranged to sell tickets and to do it all ourselves and to pay famous people to come. So the first year we had Thomas Soz, who's also still around and debating with some other people. And anyway, Cleghorn said that Thomas Soz had a screw loose, and I think he was right. But we wanted him because he was so controversial and so challenging to the mainstream, and he gets a little overexcited when he talks, but it certainly was quite an event. But they wanted to video the event, and Cleghorn told us not to, and he also told us not to tell anybody that he said no. Like, that was the Canadian part of the story. So the man who wanted to make the video got on the radio and said that he had met some young fuddy-duddies who were so conservative they wouldn't let video into a McGill event. We actually went on and did this for two more years. Maybe you want to revive this project. The second year was an infamous event because it's still called the whipped cream debate, if you ever heard about this, because we invited a radical psychiatrist from New York and Herbert Marcuse, who maybe you've never heard of, but he was like this big shot philosopher of the early 70s, and the left wing ideas of that time. And anyway, this radical psychiatrist sprayed Heinz Lehmann and the principal of McGill with whipped cream in the middle of the debate, causing a furor. And then there were people. And some Maoist groups had entered you must understand, this is the 60s, had entered the audience and got up and announced they were going to march on St. Henry and start a revolution. Although we did manage to complete the debate, this one was videotaped and was on the national news that evening. So maybe there's still a record of it. This was the end of my own left-wing tendencies, though. However, it polarized me against that point of view. The third year, we had Margaret Mead invited, and we had a whole series of exciting events which brought in hundreds of people, and we organized it ourselves, and it was all about, we're young, we're challenging the establishment, but we're opening the debate for everyone to participate in. And I think there was a nice spirit in that. I think people today are a little more, shall we say, agreeable or less rebellious than we were.
It was except for the pots and pans.
That's it. That's true. That's true. Hasn't hit psychiatry yet. Okay. We had a lot of fun in residency, and I hope you do too.
So I want to thank very much, very sincerely, Dr. Paris, for giving this wonderful talk this morning.